Good morning. This is Steve McKenna, Commissioner, Chelan County PD. I'd like to welcome you to our meeting this morning. The public is welcome. If there are participants that would like to address the agenda, please let us know for any items that are not on the agenda at this time. You will have opportunities during the agenda to address the commission. We have any items on people wish to speak to that are not on the agenda at this time? Hearing none, we will move forward with the Pledge of Allegiance with Pat O'Hara this morning.
Thank you. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Go, Pat. Pat, go ahead and start us off with a safety minute. Thank you.
Thanks. This is Pat O'Hara. I'm a credit coordinator in customer relations. This month, March, is Eye Health and Safety Month. And I like numbers a lot, so I found some numbers. Some of them are not very good. First one especially, every day 2,000 plus, that's every day, Americans suffer eye injuries. And the experts estimate that 90% of those could be prevented by wearing the proper use of safety eyewear. And 3 out of 5 of those injuries had no eye protection at all. So the obvious thing I'm going to tell you, of course, is wear eye protection. But I thought about this a while. I thought, we all know that. We've all been told that many times. I want to kind of go back a little bit and be a little more proactive and get everybody to think about this. I'm going to suggest to go out and buy some really good eyewear. Don't get the cheap ones that come with your drill or skill saw when you get it and throw them in a drawer. And pretty quick, they're all beat up and you can't see through them. And they're uncomfortable and you don't like them. So you don't really want to wear them at all. It's just at the very last minute, you say, oh, okay, I'll wear them. I'm going to suggest you go buy some really good eyewear, safety eyewear, that fits you properly. It's comfortable. I have some that are really cool. They have cheaters in the bottom too. So if I want to read or look at real small parts, they're right there. And I keep them in a good spot on top of my toolbox. There's a little area that's padded and it's out of the way of all my tools and everything. So they don't get scratched or beat up. And I know where they're always at. And I'm trying to make it a habit. So especially on the weekends or at nights, if I'm going to go do a project, I don't think, okay, do I need my glasses? I try to think, I just get my glasses and I put them on. At the very least, I put them on my head, if not on my face. And then I go about doing my project. Because if any of you are like me, a lot of times I start a project, think, oh, okay, I'm going to go do this thing. And then it ends up being like, oh, well, before I can do that project, I have to do this. And then I have to do this other thing. So you end up doing other things that you may not be prepared for. But I figure if I have my glasses on me all the time, that way, as soon as I start doing something, it's real quick and easy, and I don't get the temptation to think, oh, I don't want to stop and go back in the shop and get my glasses. I'll just do this real quick, and it'll be okay. I just have them there, so it's like a quick matter of putting them on and carrying on. And I find more and more often, too, that since I have pretty nice, comfortable glasses, I put them on, and I kind of forget I have them on there, so I keep them on. So I have protection all the time, even if I start doing something different that I hadn't had planned. So that's a big suggestion there. Go get some nice glasses. And I'm not talking about go to the dollar store, but go to one of the good hardware stores, big box stores, or any good hardware store. They'll have them. Order them online if you have to. Get ones that are comfortable and that you're going to wear and you're going to like. And they make them that look real nice, too, so you don't have to look real dorky with the dumb-looking ones that they, you know, make for a dollar. So, and then go out and wear them all the time. Get it to be your habit so you don't have to stop your project and argue with yourself and say, oh, do I really need them? Because, yes, you really need them. You don't need to take any chances. So please do that. Get some good glasses. Keep them in a good place. Take care of them and wear them all the time so that you don't become one of those 2,000 people there every day that have eye injuries. That's all I have to say about Eye Health and Safety Month. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Interesting
job, Pat.
You mentioned that. I just purchased, when I ordered my glasses to be renewed this year. I purchased a pair of safety glasses with my prescription, and they are wonderful. So
great.
Thank you for that overview.
Yeah, you're welcome. I hope everybody does it. Thanks.
All right. Commissioners, I'll be seeking approval of the agenda at this point. Do we have any items to move to the consent agenda, off the consent agenda?
Steve, this is Randy. Am I coming through on the cell phone?
We hear you, Randy. Would you like to take... go back and over?
Well, I'm wondering, since you guys are all on Teams, if maybe it might be best if you conducted it because you can see each other, and I'll participate.
Okay.
In that case, I would I think management had a recommendation of moving item 10 to the consent agenda and would suggest that we do that.
Do I hear any other additions or changes? Okay. All those in favor of moving item 10 to the consent agenda state by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Agenda stands with item number 10 moving to the consent agenda. Okay. At this time, Steve, let's move to our CPO winner recognition.
So we have two this month, and we're excited about both of them, and I believe they're both here, Jenny Conrad and Jennifer Dixon. I'll describe them both and then give them a chance to say something. Jenny is relatively new at the district. She's only been here a little more than a year in our safety office. In early January, we looked around and said, boy, this vaccine is going to be really important that our employees take it. There seems to be a lot of misinformation out there around the vaccine. We've got to find a way to communicate the importance of the vaccine. And so we gave an assignment and said we want something that's really good that's going to explain all these all the things that are going on and find a way to do that in a way that will really attract people to listen and to pay attention. Jenny, although as far as I know, she didn't have a lot of experience in terms of doing videos, came to put something together that was really good and had to do a lot of research to pull it together as well. I think there's just we were very impressed with her creativity, her initiative, and her taking personal accountability to deliver a quality product. And that was our February safety video. It's so good that we have now posted it. So even though it's not February anymore, you can still go out and watch it as we try to encourage people to get the vaccine when they become eligible. Next up is Jennifer Dixon. Jennifer does our payroll. Many of you probably know Jennifer, but and you know how thorough and diligent she is in going about her work. Normally when the state auditor comes and goes through our activities, they respond and say thanks very much to staff for the great job they've done. They went out of their way this time around to compliment Jennifer because of her really detailed approach, the ability to respond to their questions quickly with documentation. She's just a standout, and she makes everything go smoother here. But she also creates confidence in the organization. So when the state auditor comes in and takes a look at what we're doing and they can see the quality of the work, that spills over into all of our activities. So we're grateful to her for her commitment to taking personal accountability as well. Jenny, would you like to say anything?
Sorry, I just want to say thank you. You know, it was it's always a challenge when we're taking something that is constantly changing, like the coronavirus and vaccine information. And it was really a pleasure to put something together and get feedback from people saying that they felt that it helped them understand better. So that was always makes you feel good that, you know, people are appreciating what you're doing. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. And Jennifer?
I want to say thank you and also call out the payroll team, Aaron Roberts and Kathy Cowan. definitely a team activity, building documentation and making sure that we have, you know, a payroll, accurate payroll, and that we're able to document any nuances that may have happened so that when the state auditors or internal auditors come, that we are able to pull the answers quickly and respond appropriately when it, we're called upon to do that. So it's definitely a team effort in HR all around and payroll specifically. So thank you, and I thank you all on behalf of Aaron and Kathy as well.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for your hard work. And, you know, it just strikes me as two very challenging but different areas. One is the current situation with COVID, getting accurate information out, doing a great job keeping us organized, and then behind the scenes with our audit. It's so important in working with our state auditors and our private auditors to get them the best information possible so that they can be as accurate and with back to us and the public as possible as well. So thank you both. And at this time, Steve, we'll move on to you with the Shaston Water District update.
Will do. Could I interrupt just briefly to see if I'm actually back? Do you guys hear me?
Yes. Yes. We can hear you and see you.
Okay. Yes. Well, unfortunately, I have to claim it was definitely user error on my part. I thought I was on Wi-Fi and I was on cellular service. And so I'm now on Wi-Fi. So go ahead, Steve, but I can step back in, Steve McKenna, when this next section is done.
Perfect. Thank you, Randy.
Okay. We do want to talk about the Shaston Water District. They approached us more than a year ago about a possible merger with our water operation. But we've had a series of conversations with them. We've laid out some things that we thought would be important to precursors before we'd be willing to entertain such a conversation. They are stepping to the plate and addressing the concerns that we've had, so it seems like a good time to have a conversation about this. I should also mention the Water District has begun a series of public meetings about the possibility of merger. Their first meeting was last week. And with that, I'll turn it over to John Stoll and Ron Slabaugh.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Steve.
Hey, John, can I interrupt for a second and just say someone who has a phone ringing in the background, could you go on mute, please? Okay, we'll try this again, John.
Okay, I think that sounds better. So, yes, good morning, Commissioners. Steve pretty much gave the lead-in. We are at a critical point. We've spent several years working with Shaston Water District, primarily Steve Keene, their general manager. Steve's been a real pleasure to work with in his responsiveness and collaboration as we've worked together to understand holistically the overall operational, financial, and even the customer expectations within the Shaston Water District. So today we're here to report out where we stand, certainly open any questions and any feedback as we look to move forward in this effort. Ron's on the phone for any questions and comments, but I'm turning it over to Lindsay to essentially walk through the presentation. Lindsay?
Thank you, John. Good morning, Commissioners. This is Lindsay Mons, a Business Services Manager in Customer Utilities. So I would invite Ron to jump in at any point along the way, but I am taking on this presentation today as a large portion of our evaluation is currently on the financial business side of things. So today we will talk briefly about the request. I believe the commissioners are aware of this from a prior manager's item, but we'll talk a little bit more about that, some of our initial evaluation items, and then a discussion of next steps along the way. So first off, the request from the Shaston Water District was for the district to take over operations and ownership of the Shaston Water District system. This has been something that they've been working on with their community for quite some time now, and we've been looking at it evaluating various pieces of it to consider whether this was the right move for Chelan PUD and our customers. Peshawson Water District does have significant future capital improvement needs and did recently implement a multi-year rate plan to support those investments. So that's been a positive step in this evaluation. The evaluation process or approach on slide four, we did start with that consideration of whether the customers in that area, in the Peshawson area, are aware and in support of this action. And all indicators are saying yes. There have been several public meetings last year and this year where there's been positive feedback or at least no negative feedback from the customers in that area. Ron Slabaugh, the water manager, has taken a look at the system and believes the operating condition and the quality of the system indicates system health. It is, of course, always a risk when you have a system that's underground, not really knowing. So we continue, to have that in our view as we continue evaluation. But for right now, we're considering that step as a positive as well. Step three is where we're at right now, looking at financial sustainability, considering how the financial condition of Peshawson Water District looks, which I would say is positive with their recent rate actions and taking into account their future capital plans. They do look like they're in a sustainable position for their district's operations. So we now are looking at how their operations would combine with our system for the sustainability of our PUD water customers, because of course our goal is to have no negative impact on our customers. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next few slides. And then, with the board's concurrence today, the next step here would be taking a look at some of the legal hurdles that would come into play, things like easements, various other agreements that the Peshawson Water District might be currently party to, other liabilities, things that could impact the achievability of an acquisition like this. So on the financial side, I'll take us back in history just briefly for a minute here. When the Chelan PUD did our strategic plan several years ago, one of the goals was to put in place a financial sustainability plan for the water system. And we developed a 10-year plan to achieve that financial health, and the board approved rate increases for our system in January, I believe, of 2020. We also put monitoring metrics in place that were based on best practices to ensure that we continued down that path of financial health. And just as a reminder, those are the operating coverage, which takes into account our operating costs as well as our debt service. The next item is a debt service percent of revenues. So this takes a look at how much of our revenues on a monthly basis are going to pay for debt service. And then liquidity, which is really that cash in the bank in order to pay for unexpected things and normal operating needs. So Chelan PUD's financial metrics have actually improved since the time we put our rate in place. And this is primarily due to a deferral of some capital improvements. We've pushed out some plans. We were having some challenges on the liquidity side of things, which was forcing some additional debt on the water system. So as those financial plans were pushed out, the need for that additional debt was also deferred. And our liquidity, you'll see a slight bump there for a short period of time. And then when those plans start going back into place, some of our larger projects, reservoir replacements and whatnot in the next 5-year window are what brings that liquidity back down again. We see our debt service as a percent of revenue improved. We were hovering right around the target there of 10%, but now we see a consistent decline in that, which is what we want. We want to be less than that 10%. And then on the operating ratio side, generally in line with where we thought we would be meeting our target out in the 2025-26 timeframe. When we take a look at the Peshawson Water District on the next slide, using our same metrics, scaled, of course, for Peshawson Water District's size, looking at a cash position, the liquidity, Peshawson Water District's doing well. We estimate, just based on a scale of revenues, a target of around $45,000. They're well above that. You'll see the spike there in 2022 is associated with loan proceeds that would correspond with new well construction. That's their largest capital improvement project that they've got on that five-year horizon. Because those are loan proceeds, they do create a debt service requirement. And so on their debt service percent of revenue, you see a bump in that same time period. The one challenging place in the Peshawasinawara District financial results is that debt service percent of revenue. They have a significant portion of their rate revenue that is devoted to paying debt service in the range of 40 to 50%, particularly after that new loan is for the well is in place as well. When we look at best practices, which were used when we set our debt service percent of revenue, really the target there, the middle 50% of water utilities is in the 17 to 32%. So they are even above kind of that median average there. This, of course, drives the operating ratio, which is the way we set our ratio was 100% plus that revenue percentage to debt. So their target bounces around there between 140% plus. So these, I would say these targets continue to, based on the operating conditions and the financial plan of Peshawasinawara District, would still be considered healthy on their own. But when we combine them, so if we go to the next slide, Rebecca, combining them with our systems, looking at the sustainability, financial sustainability plans of a combined system, it would defer our time period to meet our financial targets. So an additional 7 years approximately for our debt service percent, and an additional 2+ years on our operating ratio. Bringing this operating ratio in line, I believe, would indicate success. So if we could make improvements to improve the operating ratio, which some of the potential opportunities listed here address that. But the debt service percent of revenues is a risk, more so in the area of it really limits what our water system is able to do in the debt arena. So in the future, large capital investments that may need to be made on our water systems, we would be really limited in our ability to debt fund those, which could potentially drive rates in the future. So there is potential that there is some impact there, and we are continuing to look at that. I would note that our next round of our Chelan PUD water system comp plan will begin planning in 2022. So we will know more about those projects through this process as well. As I mentioned, the operating ratio, improving the operating ratio can be done in several ways. It is a ratio of operating costs. Operating costs and revenues, as well as debt service. So improvements to operating revenues are one way to improve it, as well as decreasing the debt service. So opportunities there are anything that would result in less debt incurred. So utilizing reserves instead of incurring debt, advanced pay down or refinancing. And these are all, of course, on the Peshawasinawara District side of things. And then grant funding or other funding to support those large capital projects, such as the sale of water rights, any excess water rights, should they be able to be monetized, would be able to result in less debt associated with that project. It's my understanding right now that there hasn't been any grant appropriation for combining water districts at this time, but it is typically something that's there is grant funding available in the state and federal government, so we may find some opportunity there as we move through as well. And then the last opportunity there is potentially additional rate adders for Peshawasinawara District customers. Early evaluation indicated actually a $9 to $10 per month per residential service need with Peshawson Water District's recent rate action. This was able to come down. We believe an additional approximately $5 per residential customer per month would be needed on top of existing Peshawson Water District rates. So as we continue the evaluation, of course, if the board would like us to continue in this evaluation, our considerations and priorities are, of course, number one, that the acquisition would have no negative impact on our existing district water customers, and that the success would hinge on the Peshawson Water District customers being in support of this as well, with or without additional rate needs. Of course, we would not want to take on any significant known or unknown risk, and would continue to perform all necessary due diligence in that area. And just as one more note for understanding, based on experience of others, this process could take a significant amount of time in the 3+ year range. And this could have impact to other district goals and priorities, and we would take that into account and consideration along the way. Is there anything else the board would like to see as we go through this process, or goals and priorities we should have?
Commissioners, any questions for Lindsay?
I just have two comments.
I would like.
Go ahead, Gary.
Steve McKenna, and then Gary.
So, Lindsay, thank you for the presentation. I just have two ongoing comments that I have appreciation. One for our staff, that it just continues to be a very thorough look at the Peshawson Water District and what that means to that community and what it means to the larger PUD community. So I appreciate all of the efforts of our staff. There's no race to move forward with this. It's very thorough. It's taken quite a bit of time so far, and it looks like that will continue into the future. And I'm also particularly pleased with the efforts of the Peshawson Water District to address all of our questions and concerns from our staff and be very thorough in helping us with our due diligence. And so I just expect that cooperation level to continue, and for our staff to do the due diligence needed for a good, thorough decision to be made. So thank you all.
Gary.
Thank you, Randy. And Lindsay, I have two comments also, in riding on the coattails, I think, of Commissioner McKenna. First, I'd like to say how much I appreciate Peshawson Water District's cooperation in working with us on this process. And hearing you say that this might take a period of 3+ years, number one, gives me confidence that it's being looked at very carefully and nothing will be rushed into. But also, that if Peshawson Water District is willing to work with us for that period of time, it also shows good intent on their part. So I'm very appreciative of how they are working with us. But secondly, from the charge that I have with respect to being careful about risk for the district, I have to say that your list of concerns are right on target. You hit the bullseye, Lindsay. Everything you had on your list is where areas that, as I started initially looking at the document this weekend, were questions that were already building in my mind. And when I got to the last page, it was sort of like all the air got out of the balloon, because you hit every one of them right square on the head. So thank you very much for your diligence, you and your team. I have the utmost confidence in you guys, and good job.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Steve Keene, the general manager of the Peshawson Water District. May I make a couple of comments and questions also?
Absolutely.
Thank you. My biggest questions are, one, in the way of the grants and our capital improvement projects. If you noticed in our capital improvement plan, we have a new well that we'd like to get online within the next 3 years. And in order to fund that, it's going to be about $1.1 million. And one of the things that's an advantage of merging with another district is that you can get extra grant money for simply doing a merger. And then there are loans that have forgivable portions up to 50%. And so that would really affect our ability to finance that new well if it took that long to effect a merger. In other words, we would have to get separate financing without grant money in the same nature that would happen if a merger happened. So that would put that particular capital project on hold probably for at least another 3 to 5 years. And our existing water system we have four wells, one of which was decommissioned about 20 years ago because of contamination. And the other three wells are more than 50 years old and not in great condition. So we see some degradation in the amount of water we can pull out of these wells. And we've had them scoped in the past, and they're not really refurbishable, which is one of the reasons we need a new well to replace these aging wells, and then also to perfect the water rights that we have that are on hold. In order to perfect rights, you have to prove that you can pull that water out of the ground. So with our current well system, we don't have that ability. So that's another reason we need to get that well in sooner rather than later to help perfect those rights. Another issue is that we have a pending development of 137 lots that would bring in extra money to the water district. The expense of those capital improvements to put that development online would be done by the developer, and then we would have connection fees and additional customer fees that would help add to our income, which could help us balance sooner than later, providing that project happens. So I just want to make the commissioners aware of those facts, in that they were not really mentioned in this report. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Any other commissioner comments at this time?
Commissioner Smith, maybe I could just make one quick comment. I would like to add to the compliments for the Water District, and Steve Keene in particular, for the way he's moved this through in the last year. And his comments are with respect to those other issues, that we are not unfamiliar with those. One of the things I would say is on page 8, we've described a series of potential opportunities to improve the Possession Water District results that could get us to that goal of no negative impact on existing district water customers. It could be a combination of those things. It doesn't require that it's all of them. It could be a mix of them. And I think this is part of the value of continuing the conversation with the Water District. We can work through what some of the trade-offs are there, what some of the opportunities are, that would allow us to be able to make that commitment to our existing customers that they will not be worse off as a result of this, and yet at the same time be able to address the opportunities to address the growth and the need for a higher quality water supply in Peshastin. So I see opportunity here, and we appreciate the comments, and we want to continue to work with the Water District to see if we can solve these problems.
Thank you, Steve. Commissioner Smith, I have a question for Mr. Keene. Steve, you have some wells that are currently operating and because of their age may have a diminishing quality to them. You're looking at a new well. How many gallons per minute with your anticipated growth and then the diminishing of the older wells, how many gallons a minute do you have out of that new well to make your system whole?
That's a good question. Our existing wells, the three that are operating, provide about 400 gallons per minute in production. And that is sufficient for what we have right now and even for some small growth. The new well, we'd like to see something between 600 and 650 gallons per minute, both to guarantee that we have enough water and to perfect the water rights that we have.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Any other commissioner questions? So Lindsay and John and Steve, I have just a sort of a big picture question in this process, making the assumption that we've done all, we end up doing all of our due diligence, and at least for a moment in time, we understand that Peshawson will probably have to pay some additional because of the capital needs. We have a history at the utility of our water systems having a, quote, postage stamp rate. At what point in the future could we anticipate nearing that postage stamp rate once again for all customers in a new, larger system?
I'd be willing to take a shot at that. And Lindsay, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this one. That's a hard question to answer. And the reason it's a hard question to answer because it requires us to forecast the future with respect to what the state legislature is going to do in terms of providing grant funding and what the value of those water rights are that Peshawson has. So we know it appears that the state legislature is not doing much in terms of providing grant funding this year. That's a bit of a surprise to us, and we're continuing to watch that. I think there are opportunities to be able to argue for that grant funding to be returned, but that's one that we're not in control of. We have looked at, taken our water rights experts and taken a look at the Peshawson water rights. There's a fair amount of effort that will be required to define what's necessary to perfect those water rights. And again, that's uncertain. So this is why we've said we see that there is a potential value going down that path, and we're interested in working with the water district to try to find ways to be able to capture value there. But we can't be certain that it will happen. And short of that, we'd probably need a rate adder of some kind to be able to get to that no net impact. So I wish I could give you a better forecast of the future, but that's what we know at this point.
Okay. Randy, this is Steve. I have one more comment, if I could, please.
Yes.
I think it would be important as we talk about the length of time moving forward for our public to hear that this, we still have more work to do. I think it's also important for any public that may be listening to this meeting online or the recording, is that this process has been going on for several years already. And I know I as a new commissioner coming on, I think I've been involved with this 3 or 4 years. So this has been a fairly lengthy process, a very thorough process, and I appreciate Steve's comments that there are opportunities in the future, and we need to keep on this, keep looking at it, and keep moving forward with our work. Yes. So I just wanted to make that historical perspective, too.
John,
thank you.
When you consider the time frame, actually, we first approached the PUD in 2017, and then there was the Wenatchee Valley consolidation study in 2018, and then we made our presentation to the PUD in November of 2018. So it's been almost 4 years since we started this process.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Well, once again, to echo the rest of my fellow commissioners, Lindsay and John, you guys are doing a great job of due diligence, and we look forward to making progress.
Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the public on the last presentation? I'll turn it back to Steve then for what on my agenda says long-term marketing strategy.
Okay, commissioners, I'm going to ask you to put your seatbelts on because this one's going to take a little while, a lot longer than a normal presentation, but marketing is a really key issue for us. It allows us to keep our rates as low as they are. And candidly, this is a bit of a change. This was not something that we highlighted in the strategic plan. I'd say it's an addition in some respects. There was some discussion of it, but just not the kind of emphasis that we're now placing on it. primarily because the market has moved in a really significant way. While I say it was not in the strategic plan, we did have elements that discussed long-term marketing and the importance of that. And in the last year's performance plan, we talked about beginning to develop our thoughts about wholesale versus retail loads, what we might be able to do in that arena. And in the midst of doing that, we've seen the market move in our favor in the last 2 years, particularly this last year. We are, unfortunately, not good enough at forecasting to say whether good markets will be retained for the long term or not. And so this creates an opportunity for us that we think is there to make hay while the sun shines. Not only that, there may be an opportunity here, just to add another metaphor, that the current market may be an opportunity to have our cake and eat it too. And what I mean by that is we have struggled with the question of whether to sell at wholesale, where the revenues are the highest, versus sell here in the county in order to create economic development. And we're seeing the possibility of potentially being able to do both, to be able to sell at wholesale prices and to be able to attract some local load here that would create economic development opportunities. So describe that further as we go through this package. I want to start by just describing that we have an existing amount of inventory. We're thinking a lot more about this in terms of a stressed water versus average water condition just because of the way the markets are moving. I'll describe more in a moment about why. The stressed water condition, you can see that the gray areas in these bars show the amount of available surplus that we have. We don't have a lot in the next couple of years, but it does grow a lot as the Alcoa contract goes away and ultimately the Puget contract terminates as well. You can see under average water conditions that we also continue to have a substantial amount of surplus that's available, particularly in those later years. Just to set the context here, our current marketing I think of as 50-30-20, 50% in cost of production-based contracts, 30% in fixed price market-based contracts, and 20% at retail. These numbers take into account that we have some uncertainty. We have reserves on our system we have to maintain. We've got the Canadian entitlement obligations. So take that off the top and what's left. The 50% long-term cost-based contracts were also signed with an upfront capacity reservation payment. So that's a pretty big contribution that gets added. The 30% contracts have been marketed mostly, in fact, all but one of them, in five-year sales. A few years ago, with board approval, we moved to the opportunity to make a 10-year sale. We've made one of those. And then, of course, there's the 20% at retail. We'll talk more about that in a moment, about how it doesn't really grow very much through time. This mix basically creates diversification. So we have cost-based and market-based contracts, takes advantage of the fact that there are different types of risks that we're confronted with, and gives us a better chance of being able to manage those risks. So how has that worked out for us? Actually, it's worked out really well. We've had some really strong financial years, and we've had a fair amount of comfort about the stability of revenues because of the diversification in the contracts that we offer. The cost-based contracts have produced pretty steady margins, and they mitigate the risk of rising hydro system costs. The market-based contracts have produced very healthy revenues, with the amount varying depending on wholesale market conditions. In general, the market has been declining since about 2012 or 2013, although we did see 1 year in which there was a better, that trend line was not realized, things were better. So you can translate all of that into the numbers at the bottom of the page. In 2020, our market-based slice contracts produced a little more than $34 a megawatt hour, and our cost-based slice contracts produced a little less than $30 a megawatt hour. we looked backwards and forwards just to say, is that a reasonable approximation of what's happening in both the what we've experienced in the last 5 years and versus what we expect to experience in the next 5 years? And that $5 differential is a pretty good proxy. So we have done better with market-based slice than with cost-based. Again, though, that market-based slice has been trending downward for a number of years, so it raises some questions about where it will go in the longer run. Both these types of contracts mitigate both stream flow and outage risk for us. And, of course, the cost-based contracts go a step beyond that and mitigate our own hydro system cost risk. It's important to recognize that these revenues are just critical to us. Our retail revenue is increasingly separated from our retail cost. The net gap is nearing 50%, so our 3-cent rate is our actual costs are more in the 6-cent range. So we really are heavily dependent on these revenues for being able to maintain the rates that we have, and this is why it's so important to be able to go market when the markets are good. Okay, let's do a little situational awareness, what's changed in the last few years, and in particular going back to when the overall marketing strategy was put in place some 10 years ago. First of all, we do have a strategic plan that seeks to support retail load growth for economic development, but as long as that doesn't have a retail rate impact that exceeds 5%. We're seeing in the market, I've said a couple times, declining energy values, but at the same time as we're seeing these declining energy values, which primarily hits our 5-year fixed price contracts, we're seeing increasing environmental and think of this in terms of as a carbon price, increasing value for being carbon free and increasing value for capacity as the region looks like it's projecting to be short in the next few years. The longer-term contracts are likely to capture the highest value because they more clearly capture this carbon and capacity values, because a utility who is purchasing will be able to not have to build a new resource, and that's critical in terms of the value that they would place on it. We think it's possible that in the future the capacity and environmental values may equal or exceed the energy values. In fact, it's possible for a longer-term contract that that's true today. Another factor to take into account here is that we are seeing, particularly in the energy markets, not so much capacity and carbon, but we're seeing increased volatility. We see long periods of low energy prices interspersed with bursts of high prices. We saw this last month, where we saw very high prices, in part as just a result of the activity that was going on in Texas and the Midwest. That impacted gas prices all the way across the country and led to higher prices in the Northwest. We saw it in 2019 when there was a gas pipeline explosion in British Columbia that limited supply coming out of Canada. So these periods happen when the system is stressed, and when it's stressed, it tends to lead to very high prices for relatively short periods of time, a couple of weeks to a month. Consequently, the carbon and capacity values may provide more stable revenues over time, but again, those are more likely to be captured if we're doing long-term marketing. More on the situational awareness front, we have load changes at the retail level. Well, we did establish the high-density load rate a couple of years ago that allows us to capture load growth at the cost of production instead of at our subsidized rates. And those rates are also established and controlled by the board. The board can make decisions about what those rates will be. We do have a pretty small annual load growth. Actually, when you think about our total supply, it's been averaging about 2 average megawatts, so it's just 1% of the current retail loads. If you think about that in terms of, let's say, the next 20 years, that means that we're looking at 40 megawatts of load growth, which is less than one of our annual slice sales currently. We've been making some progress to develop a solar or green product to sell to a large retail load, so this would be an opportunity to sell on something other than our hydropower system. We've also done a lot of work with respect to developing wholesale pricing options for large new loads in Chelan County, the biggest one of which was the new transmission rate that was adopted by the board last summer that creates the opportunity to be able to, if a local load wanted to import power, they could do so. And we are seeing some interest in that product. A couple other areas that continue to change for us, clearly resource adequacy has become a huge issue in the Northwest. As we look forward and see coal plants being retired that were a really integral part of the Northwest electric power system, the value of capacity, the something that you can count on to be there even under stress conditions, is increasing. There is a lot of work going on in the region, and I would say some of the best and brightest people in the region are working on trying to define a resource adequacy standard. There's a lot of uncertainty still about how that will be calculated, and the way that's calculated could make a difference in terms of how much capacity we need to retain just to make sure that we would meet a resource adequacy standard for our own system. And there is a reducing value of variable stream flow hydropower, because that difference between stress water and average water is something that, as a utility, you can't count on that water being there and therefore that energy being there on every year. And that means that it probably won't count for resource adequacy purposes. So the value of that product is decreasing. And as we see more solar and wind added to the system, which is also a variable energy resource that is not always there, that also is a creates more supply of that product, which tends to reduce the value. Finally, there is the fact that we are no longer operating in coordination with Douglas, Grant, and Bonneville. The independent hydropower operations impacts our flexibility and, to some extent, our value. We continue to push for moving back to some sort of coordinated operation, a much more modernized coordinated operation. But so far, we still are quite a ways away from being able to come to any such agreement. So you might ask, why market long-term now? We've got a few years. The Alcoa contract doesn't expire until 2028, Puget till 2031. In the utility world, those long-term contracts termination is in sight. Utilities, it takes a long time to develop resources, whether it's generation, transmission, even energy efficiency or demand response, take a long time to develop in the magnitudes of what we're talking about here. And so it's become a relevant question, and that has become even more so because of some of the things that are happening in the legislative arena. Market for longer term is good now, because of the state mandates that increase the need for being able to have clean capacity to provide reliable service. Certainly the resource adequacy challenges, the more that people run the numbers and they look at what the likelihood is of being able to provide the supply that will meet the regional needs is creating concern about whether we will have a significant inability to be able to maintain reliability on the system. And the Comprehensive Energy Transformation Act in Washington State does drive planning now for post-2030, because there are very specific goals that kick in 2030 that utilities have. And again, most utilities 10 years out doesn't feel like very long away. There is some downside, potentially, if we wait. There is the potential, because there are these big resource adequacy problems, for government mandates to kick in, particularly mandates that would require the use of storage. If it were overbuilt, could create a reduction in value for our hydropower. And try as we might, I'm not sure that I actually regret using the word unsuccessful here in terms of trying to create subsidy for the parity for the subsidies for hydropower that exist out there in the marketplace, because we have had some success. We don't see as much renewable portfolio standards that don't include hydropower. But in things like tax credits and others, so far we have not been successful in making the case that hydropower should be treated the same as other renewable resources. So it does seem like a good time now to to get out while the market is good, and just in case something were to come along that would decrease the value of hydropower. What about the risks to consider about the different types of contracts? So you can think of this generally as there are risks associated with going shorter term, and there are risks associated with going longer term. The risk of going shorter term are essentially that the market prices may decrease, that things could come along that would decrease the value of our product, or that things might come along that would decrease the output of our product. Either of those would create significant challenges to produce the kind of revenue that we need to be able to maintain the rates that we have here in Chelan County. On the longer term side, if you sign up now, there are certainly reasonable, very plausible scenarios that the market value may increase from where it is today. It's hard to see today how the capacity problems that the region has are going to get it solved in a timely way. This is more than just a, well, we've got to build a bunch of stuff. It actually is a technology problem in that there isn't enough clean capacity out there today to be able to produce the same kind of reliability and carbon-free that that the region is seeking. So, again, pretty plausible scenarios that waiting may lead to a market value increase. The longer-term contracts, though, now do create the ability to capture this capacity value. And importantly, we think there's probably a pretty good chance that we could have a what I would call a no-regrets policy if we go longer-term, because it's you miss out on opportunity costs. You could miss out on some higher values, but you still end up with something that creates a fair amount of stability and confidence in the Chelan community that there's a low exposure to very high rate increases. Next up. Let me just pause for a moment because this is a long presentation. Any questions so far from the board? Okay.
Steve, I have one.
Uh-huh.
And it goes back to close to the very beginning. And I don't know if it means anything, but we've been doing a significant amount of rehabilitation on our hydro system ever since I've been a commissioner, and it's continuing forward, but we seem to be getting, especially on Rock Island, to a point of nearing some level of completion. Will that make a difference to us in our capacity going forward?
It certainly makes a difference compared against today because we have so many units out. In terms of increasing the amount of capacity, it's pretty small. There are some modest improvements, but this is the problem that we have is the engineering on hydropower has been so good for so long that our ability to translate the BTUs and falling water into electricity has been pretty good for decades, actually. So we do see some modest improvements, but just not a lot that it would factor into this in a significant way. The one area that there is a big opportunity in is the Columbia River Treaty entitlement return. We know we're way overpaying on that. We're returning roughly about 50 average megawatts today, and that is a significant opportunity for us.
Okay, thank you.
Steve, I have a question, and perhaps this should be held until the end of your presentation, but the benefit of the contracts that have helped pay for maintenance and repair on our hydro project, has that benefit, that cost that has been shared, factored into the numbers that you're presenting today?
Yes. So that go back to that cost of production. You don't need to go back to the page, but just as a reminder for the board, that that $29 price is making sure that for 50% of our O&M costs that we're getting a payment for that, and no matter which direction it goes. And so we've had some increasing O&M costs in the last few years, and that has helped to cover that cost.
And that's part of the $29, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll pick up on the current market environment. Try to divide these market segments into five pieces here. Northwest IOUs, Northwest Publics, Marketers, California Utilities, and External Retail Entities. Each of those creates a challenge for us in terms of marketing to them. The Northwest IOUs operate under very strict procurement processes that are set by their state utility commissions. We do think there is opportunity there, but the rules continue to change, and the CETA is continuing to change the rules as well as for how Washington utilities will be able to participate in purchasing resources for the long term. The Northwest Publics, a key issue for us is we will not be competing with BPA on price. We would expect that our price would be higher than Bonneville's. And in addition to that, the Northwest Publics are accustomed to a supplier relationship with Bonneville where they have a significant amount of input on cost decisions. That's not a relationship that we're really interested in replicating. We believe that these assets should be operated for the best value for the most people for the longest period of time. And if you have a contract with an entity and say it's a 20-year contract and you're 10 years into it, their interest is in the remaining 10 years of the contract and maybe not so much for the longer term. So there are some challenges there in terms of being really clear that we would, if a Northwest Public wanted to purchase from us, it would be a different relationship than what they have with Bonneville. Marketers buy a lot of our product in the shorter term, the 5-year slice. Type contracts. We may well be moving to longer term, as we'll talk about in a bit more in just a moment. That creates greater counterparty risk with respect to entities that are not load-serving entities may have more credit challenges for us than is serving an existing utility. We could always look south to the California utilities. We know that ultimately some of our power is going there today, that the marketers are purchasing. We've had some conversations with California utilities. There are some pretty significant issues in terms of transmission access, some getting to the border, probably as much or more inside of California. The transmission access there and the regulatory structure there creates a lot of challenges in terms of being able to strike a bargain that you can be confident will last for a long term. And then there are the external retail entities. What we mean by this is we are now selling to Microsoft. So we're selling to a retail load in someone else's service territory. That's because there was a special dispensation given to Microsoft to be able to operate outside of the taking service from Puget Sound Energy. There's not a lot of that around, in the Northwest at least. And in addition to that, we can only serve that load most likely if we had a partner. So we're able to serve the Microsoft load because we're doing it in conjunction with PowerX. That makes it difficult to try to put together more arrangements like that. All of these are options that are on the table. I would say certainly all of them are on the table for any kind of an auction type arrangement where we sell our fixed price slice type contracts. With respect to the longer-term contracts, you can probably think of this as being prioritized from top to bottom, that those are the most likely market segments that we would be interested in, although we will certainly keep the door open to any and all.
Steve, can I just ask a question, just for clarification?
Yes, please.
On that last slide,
mm-hmm.
You were suggesting that item number 5, we would need a partner. Just help me to understand, would a partner be someone like PowerX? Is that a partner you're talking about?
Yeah, our challenge is that we don't really have enough flexibility in our system to serve large amounts of load and 24/7 to guarantee that kind of service. We really do need a partner, and PowerX has been a very good partner for us with respect to the Microsoft sale.
Thank you.
try to pause after each page, too. If there are any questions, it's probably better to take them as we go along. So next up, we've begun to talk a little bit about who we might sell to and then what might we sell. Should the 50-30-20 arrangement or at least allocation change? So we know that there is an interest in growing retail loads for economic development. We certainly heard that in the strategic planning process. We know that we can't do that with our current retail rate and still meet our rate objectives. With the exception of if we use the high density load rate, which is more like cost of production, certainly substantially higher than our retail rate, but below the current market value. And that's something that has changed. When we put the HDL rate in place 3-4 years ago, we were really only seeing the energy values. We weren't seeing the capacity and carbon values. And at that point, the cost of production type rate was looking like it could be at least in the range of a market rate. Today, not so much true. Again, we've seen the market move in the last year or two. Could we guarantee that that will stay that way? Nope, couldn't do that. So that's the way it stands today. But there probably would be some limitations of what we could do with the HDL rate today and still meet the 5% rate limit for existing customers. We may be able to offer wholesale pricing to new Chelan County loads, again, using either a hydro-based product, so the same product that we would offer to an entity outside of Chelan County, or allowing power to be imported into the county so that if someone wanted to purchase and just use our transmission system, there are ways to be able to do that with the new transmission rates that we put in place. So there are ways to accomplish economic development, we think, while still meeting the 5% target, but there are some things that don't work for us too, and so we have to be clear about that. The cost plus longer term contracts, they do give us this combination of value. They provide margin and they provide stability in, relative to our generation costs. We do think that the pricing could be structured different than the way we're doing it today to capture more, but not all of the difference between market and cost. And I'll talk some more in a moment about why not to capture all, but we do think that we could probably do better than we are with our current cost plus contracts. And we think there's also an opportunity to modify those cost plus contracts to require a greater commitment by purchasers to help us when there are state or federal actions that affect hydropower value. That could be either in an upward or a downward direction. So help us with respect to trying to get changes to the Columbia River Treaty, some of the environmental regulations that come along. There could be opportunities here to expand our ability to work in partnership with those who are purchasing under long-term contracts. The market-based shorter-term contracts still have value too, though. They potentially are the highest value based on the historical prices that we've seen, much more volatile. I think there's always been some sense that combining these two, the stable revenues with cost plus a market-based contract, helps to manage what is the volatility that would be associated if we were only going with market-based contracts. We think we could continue to test the market acceptance of longer-term contracts. Like I said, we did one a couple of years ago. We're seeing right now, even in the last 6 months or so, greater interest in something like a 10-year contract from load-serving entities. So we think that there could be an interest there and an opportunity to get a better price because we'd be able to get some of that capacity value. Now, there is some value as well to not going all long-term because it retains the flexibility to translate a market-based contract into a retail sale. So with our current 5-year laddered slice approach, every year essentially 50 megawatts becomes available, which this board or a future board can redirect to sell at retail. If we were to go to 10-year contracts, then that would mean 50 megawatts would be available every 2 years. That would be available. That's still a pretty substantial amount of energy that creates some flexibility and discretion for, again, either this board or a future board to decide how it should be distributed. So I'm going to move to a proposal at this point for how we move forward and some actions that we would take to implement that. Our current thinking is, you know, the basic structure of the 50-30-20 works, but we need to create a little bit of flexibility because we've got to create some room for retail load growth that could occur. We're thinking that cost-plus contracts would be not more than the current amount, could be a bit less, so somewhere between 40-50%, and would be made available for new large loads in Chelan County. You can even think of this as not that much different than what we do today because, of course, we were selling 25% to Alcoa previously. The marketplace-based slice contracts, again, would not be higher than the historical high of 30%, could be as low as 20%, and we want to explore extending the term to 10 years to try to capture that higher value that we think is out there, but retain the fact that there would be the ability, at least every couple of years, to have megawatts that are freed up and available for use here in the county. And I should say, when we've seen economic development, for the most part, it doesn't show up and it's ready to take a large amount of power on day one. In fact, it's very difficult for us to serve. Just the putting in place transmission, distribution, other things that are necessary gives us at least some time to be able to take advantage of the fact that these slice fixed price sales would be rolling off. Retail loads, we assume, will grow. Could be up to about 10% or so as we try to manage that in a fashion that it doesn't create more than a 5% retail rate impact. The choice between whether we roll off cost plus or market-based slice contracts, we basically are saying we don't have to make that decision today. We can be testing the market and trying to figure out whether we go all the way to 50% for marketplace for cost plus and all the way to 30% for market basis or options that we have available to us. We just need to know that generally we'll have to make some choices there about reducing likely one or the other. Just to make sure it's clear, all of our operational reserves are taken off the top again, so we'll make sure that we're meeting all of our requirements, including Columbia River Treaty commitments, but that Columbia River Treaty commitment, it does create a potential for some additional supply to come onto our system. We do plan to protect against market volatility. We got more conservative last year with the way we marketed because of the fact that we're seeing these short periods of really high prices, and we want to create minimal exposure to being short. I will tell you that's getting harder and harder to do, but that's our commitment to try to make sure. In fact, I couldn't say that we could do it 100% probability, but we're trying to reduce that probability and keep it very low. And we're interested in trying to develop a market for this variable hydropower product, this stream flow product. Again, it's got a lower value, but there may be ways to be able to sell it to someone that is interested and willing to take a product that they know in advance they can't count on, that there will be some years in which we'll have low water and they would get less energy, or some months when they might get less energy. There may be even a way to combine that where you could take advantage of the bursts of high prices and say, when there's really high prices, we will reduce our deliveries to that entity. The combination of that may create more value than just trying to sell into spot markets. I will warn you that this has been the holy grail for hydro systems for at least 30, 40 years, and a lot of effort has been put into trying to find a load like this without much success so far. But the market is always moving, and there are new entrants to the market, and so we're trying to find out if there some of those new market entrants, that their business models would allow them to take advantage of a variable hydropower product.
Steve, this is Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes, hear you good.
Good. Yeah, so I'm just trying to, when I read that, I had question marks, and I'm still trying to figure out who and why would anybody be interested in a really variable product like that that's so unpredictable. I mean, how and who would benefit from that?
Well, I'll give you two examples. It has been suggested at times that a cryptocurrency load might be able to operate this way because they can be in and out of their market. They can stop producing and then turn it back on. Now, they give up revenue, but their peaks in terms of value are not necessarily tied to our peaks in terms of stream flow. You know, they're two totally different products. So it's possible that they might be able to make a business like that work. We've done some work on this, and it doesn't look like it's a non-starter, but it worries them. I'll be honest. It worries them that we would be in control of when they would be able to operate or not. A lot of this comes down to pricing, too. What kind of price could we put in place? A second... The second example would be a hydrogen producer. The concept here is that you have an electrolyzer that translates water into, separates it into hydrogen and oxygen using electricity, and that they may have some ability to modulate their loads. We have a lot more work to understand exactly what they can do and what they can't do to make their business model work there.
But it seems to me that we would have to sell this at quite a reduced price. I mean, they'd have to get, in order to get them to take this kind of variable product, they'd pay considerably less. I mean, they would pay more. I'm sorry. Are you still there?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking out loud here, but. I don't understand how it makes sense for them unless we offer it at a price that is not good for us.
Well, the way I think about this is take the price that we could get in the wholesale market for our firm product, and we might decrement that for the value they could provide for modulation. So if they can modulate for short periods of time, that has some value to us, and it probably would be a modest decrease in price. If they could modulate all the way to when we have a low water year, that they would take less energy across the entire year, and then when we have a high water year, they would take more, that becomes a much more valuable product to us. And the difficulty...
It does.
Yeah, the difficulty that we have is that the variability in stream flow, that product that we've got, is decreasing in value in the market today. So,
that's true.
So we have to think about this across the full array of options that they would have to modulate. And I've counted somewhere between 6 to 7 different ways that they might be able to modulate, each of which has a different value in the market. And so we'd have to try to figure out what can you do and how much is that worth to us, and see if we can come up with something that makes sense.
Yeah, because they're going to be paying, with the current setup, with the current program, they're paying higher rates than they'd like to pay. So if this is a little piece that they could work with, all right, I'm beginning to see where you're going with it. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, to be honest, what I'm trying to do is say I think there's an opportunity here, but again, I'm going to come back to this is the holy grail for the hydropower industry that's been sought for I don't know, 40 or 50 years without success so far. But there are a couple of different types of users out there than we've seen in the past, and maybe there's hope for them.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Steve, this is Dennis. Can we go back up on page 11, please? Page 11, and then retail loads. Can you give me your definition of a retail load?
Well, at this point, it would be a load that's served at our, I'll call it our subsidized rate, our traditional rate, or a high-density load rate.
Okay. So my question then is, currently, aren't we at about 19 to 20% of our generation being utilized for local retail loads? Is that a fair number or not?
Yeah, it's in the ballpark.
Okay, so really the only place that 20 to 30% could be is to if it goes up. So it's not going to go down. It would only go up. So, making an allowance in there for that expansion is kind of what I'm, is that a reasonable thought?
Yep. And it's going to have to come out of either the cost plus contracts or the market based slice contracts.
Okay, so that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, and I said that a little too quick. I mean, there is this possibility of using imported power, and so we could have, although we tend to put that in the cost plus contract type approach. Think about it that way. But so we haven't done this. We think it's possible to do that. We might be able to serve a load in Chelan County with imported power. So that you have to kind of put that one on the side.
Okay, but if we imported, wouldn't that put the cost for our local customers up?
If we import it, no, because it would not be us importing it. I'm glad you asked that question. I should have been more clear on this. So what we were doing is the load would be paying the full imported power cost. So what you get is the economic development without using our hydro system and therefore without an impact to our retail customers.
And thank you very much for clarifying that. I get it. Thanks.
Yeah, we are not thinking about importing and then melding it into our existing system. It would be an import for the purpose of serving a specific customer.
And yeah, that would be passed through to that specific customer. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to translate that proposal into the types of actions that we would consider taking. So first of all, and we'll talk some more about this in just a moment, defining principles and exploring markets for the post-27 Alcoa contract and the post-2031 Puget contracts, generally thinking of those as long-term cost-plus terms. We'd be looking for commitments to be supportive of hydropower, things that will help to manage costs for us. Want some strong provisions that Chelan would control the investment decisions, capital and O&M. We'd want really strong credit provisions because it's a long-term contract, so you really want somebody that you're confident is going to be there. And we'd seek to capture a portion, but not all, the difference between cost and projected market. We would plan to explore market-based sales, save 5 to 10 years. We're leaning more towards the 10 years than the 5 years. We would plan to create some room for retail economic development growth out of either the slice or the long-term contract allocations, to be determined as to how much, probably leaning more towards the fixed price, market price contracts as the more likely way we would make that work. But again, with our commitment to making sure that we don't have more than a 5% retail rate impact for our existing customers. We would plan to continue to develop this wholesale priced hydro product that could be offered to a load that comes to Chelan County, and also a solar green product as an alternative that where the purchaser would pay the full cost of that. And we'd market that to larger new loads. We hope to develop a market for a variable stream flow product, and we want to retain a small amount, say 1%, in the short-term variable market, just for comparison purposes, so we can keep track of how are we doing in our longer-term sales versus if we had chosen to go shorter-term. you know, in a lot of markets, going short term and going variable is the better way to go. This is a bit of a unique market because of the large capital investments that are necessary and willingness of parties to pay more to assure supply over the longer term. But there's no guarantee it will always stay that way. I want to pause there before we go to the next section, which is proposals with respect to guiding principles that we would use for both the overall long-term marketing portfolio as well as for cost-plus contracts. Okay. I don't think these will surprise anyone based on the presentation, but we'll just walk through them. Principles for the overall portfolio, the sales that we would make. We want to make sure that we retain sufficient power to meet the current and long-term needs, especially for those under 5 megawatt loads that we have historically served. And in fact, to try to manage things so that the rates will be predictable. We do want to provide some power products for larger than 5 megawatt loads to try to support economic development, but do so in a fashion that won't violate the 5% retail rate impact for existing customers. This next one is a bit of a guess. I'm going to admit that right now. But we think that it's possible that we should set a goal to provide adequate revenues from our wholesale marketing program to provide stable and predictable retail rates that do not exceed inflation through about 2035, and it could be longer. While at the same time achieving our strategic goals for hydro system capability, distribution reliability, and safety. So the last strategic plan called for really upping our game in trying to get to specific targets for hydro system capability and distribution reliability and safety, and all of those have costs associated with them. It's part of the reason that the gap is growing between what we currently charge and what our actual costs are. So it will take revenue in order to be able to support that. We think that it's possible the market may be in a good place to be able to support that goal today. We don't actually have the financial tools today to be able to do this analysis. It's one of our goals is to and we've been working on it to begin to put ourselves in a position to be able to do that. It's probably going to be at least a couple of years before we're actually fully able to pull off that analysis. But as a rule of thumb, we think that this is possible for us to succeed at. We want to create templates for our take-or-pay contracts and our fixed market price contracts so that when we go out and we market and we put contracts in place, we don't have a bunch of different contracts that become really difficult to administer and expensive to administer then. I want to try to make sure we're marketing in a fashion that we have high assurance of not being short to meet our district obligations during wholesale price spikes, at least to minimize the risk of that. I have a mix of fixed price and cost plus contracts just because of the way it helps us to manage stream flow, outage risk, and cost risk. And this last one we haven't talked about much. Let me just spend a minute on that. We want to make sure that we minimize or at least not have high risk of concentration of our wholesale sales such that they could be too much for one counterparty or too much for one geography. Probably the board is familiar with the idea of counterparty concentration risk, that you know, one entity goes bankrupt and you're tremendously exposed. The geography concern is a natural disaster concern. So let's say we're selling a whole bunch into one small area and you have a natural disaster. Now you've lost all of your revenues or a substantial portion of your revenues due to the fact that they're all gone at that point. Any questions about that?
Yeah, again, Steve, taking a look, can you give me an example? And it would be related to number two. Can you give me an example of what might be a 5-megawatt load? What size of a business would that be if it came in one chunk?
I'm trying to remember, and maybe John is on. He can correct me if this is not right. I think Stimelt is a little under 5.
Okay.
So we do not, up until the Diamond Foundry, and the Diamond Foundry still has not exceeded this, we have not had an above 5-megawatt load on our system.
All right. That's really helpful to know. Thank you.
Yes, Steve, this is John. You're correct. And I would say of our roughly 30-some industrial customers, the last time I looked, about the average load is about 2 megawatts.
Okay. So what's a Safeway-type store? Is that a megawatt?
No. I can double check on this, but I think they're more around the 300 kW or
20. Okay. Yeah.
A large store.
No need to check any further. That seems reasonable. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Hello, Steve. This is Gary.
Okay.
I have a question with respect to the proposal, and if we were to move towards a 2030 mix, what currently we're roughly in round numbers, where retail load is about 20. So that means we're talking perhaps about 10 more. What happens to that 10 while we're waiting for new businesses to establish themselves in the county? How's that 10 treated?
Yeah, I want to correct one thing. So the 20 to 30 is a percentage of our total supply. And so our current load would be about 200 megawatts. And if a retail load were to go to 30%, it would move up to about 300 megawatts. So it's actually 100 megawatts that would be there and available. So the thought is that's way too much power to have it sit around and just sell in the spot market. We don't want to do that. That's losing too much revenue. So we would sell it, and the trade-off here becomes how much goes into the cost-plus contracts that are probably 20-year contracts, how much goes into the market-based contracts that are 10-year or 5-year contracts. The expectation that those market-based contracts, that they would roll over, in effect, one would roll over every 2 years, even if we sold all of them in 10-year allotments, would mean that you'd have about 50 megawatts that would become available every other year. And so we would definitely be trying to market longer term to capture as much revenue as we can, but retain some flexibility to be able to pull that back as local load shows up. And we think 2 years' notice is reasonable for a load of this size, that it would be darn near impossible for us to serve a load of this size flick the switch. Too much work has to go into development of the transmission and distribution system to be ready for a load of that size. Did I get your question
Thank
right,
you.
Commissioner Arsenault? I just want to check and see.
It did. Thank you. I was trying to wrap my head around how would we keep that load flexibility and at the same time maximize the economic value. I think you've answered the question.
So, Steve, this is Randy, and I anticipate that there probably are some people on our call today. I know there's several phone numbers out there that might want to offer thoughts. Whenever you think the appropriate time is, I would open that up for input from the public.
I'd like to get through one more page, and then I'll be done.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay.
I want to talk about the principles for cost of production type contracts. These first few are, I'll just, one and two, I think you can think of them as we want to maintain as much flexibility in control of operation and the maintenance decision making for both the hydro system and the network transmission system, both operation and maintenance, and then number two, asset investment and financing. And in fact, you could even include number four, which is our current cost plus contracts actually allow us to collect for capital improvements as we go, rather than waiting until the end. That was what was described as a flaw in the earlier contracts, is that they didn't create that opportunity and created a tendency for underinvestment in the system. So trying to make sure that we do have the capability to make sure that the costs are being covered and that we don't have a disincentive to making investments that will ensure these assets are here for the long term. Number three is basically getting to making sure that all the district's costs that go into energy capacity and other ancillary services products are included in the contract. That's was in the previous principles for the existing contracts as well. Want to make sure that we've got contractual commitments that align with the fact that we are now operating independently, but we also want to create incentives to support potential future coordination, because that's where we would like to see things go. The cost of production contracts need to include all the costs associated with hydro generation and transmission, including this pay-as-you-go capital. We want to ensure there is counterparty support for legislative or regulatory issues of mutual interest that could enhance the value of hydro and the network transmission systems. We want folks to be in there fighting with us if there are things that are going on that are impacting the value of the system. And we're trying to think that through in terms of what kinds of issues might come up so that we are future-proofing these contracts about potential legislative or regulatory issues that could come up. This last one's important. So we want to capture a portion, but not all, the difference between cost-based and market-based contracts to promote long-term collaborative partnerships and revenue stability. And I think there could be a question about, well, why not just go for it all? And there are three reasons that I would identify, there may be more, that address the why. First, we'd be asking purchasers to take risk because they're going to be sharing in the risk of our cost-based product, and that means that they don't know for sure what will happen with what our costs will be. It's not a fixed price, and so that would tend to lead to a reduction in value. Second, we want to control the capital decisions. So if we have a product that's priced right at market, it tends to encourage people to want to, purchasers, to want to argue with us about, well, wait a second, you're now making decisions that are pushing this price above market. We don't want to have those kind of arguments. We want the value to be defined and to assure that that the district is able to make the best possible investment decisions to make sure that these assets will be operating 50, 75, 100 years from now. And third, candidly, we'd like this to be a good enough deal that people who are participating with us are, when we face legislative or regulatory challenges, that we have partners who are in there really wanting to be with us because they believe that there is value to them as well in terms of trying to work to create value, enhancements of value, or avoid the degradation of value that can occur in legislative and regulatory arenas. And with that, that is the end of the presentation. I'll take more questions from the board, and if you wanted to open it up for public comment.
So, Steve, I'd like to make a couple of comments before I even ask board members. It really came through to me loud and clear in your presentation. Some of the similarities between marketing and sales, and they are not the same. Electricity and fresh fruit have a lot in common. Fresh fruit is highly perishable and has to be sold on a date certain. And if you don't make it, you end up having to dump it. And electricity, I don't think we sometimes have to dump it if we don't have it put together, the package put together right. And what you're laying out here is a very complex picture of power sales and marketing And I, for my fellow commissioners, I just like, I don't think anybody's maybe heard this story, but when we were first tying our wagon and our fruit sales to Walmart, Walmart didn't just want to buy our fruit. They wanted to buy our services. They wanted our people, our marketers, to reach into their inventory nationwide and fulfill certain needs that they had. There's so many similarities to what you've laid out. It's complex, and I don't pretend to be a marketer or a salesperson, either one. And so, you know, what you've put together is a template for something that I think is really very powerful for our organization that we probably haven't had before. And so I'm excited about what you've laid out here. I know there's commissioners probably have some questions and others on the line, so I'll stop there. But I just wanted to share with you that how that just hit me, that the similarities there.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioners, any other questions at the moment before I open it up to others that are listening? I know we've got several cell phones on the call today, and if there's anybody that wants to provide any input to talk about the presentation that we've just heard, I would ask that you identify yourself, your name and address, and if you've got comments to make, if you would limit those comments to 3 minutes or less, we would appreciate that. And if there's time, if more people want to talk, we can circle back around. So we'll open the mic, I guess, is the way we put it. No comment from the public? All right. Well, if there's no additional input at this time, commissioners, any final words for Steve? And Steve, any what direction you want to take us with this?
Randy, I have one more comment, if I may, please. When we were on page 14, item number 9, you know, the concept to promote long-term collaborative partnerships, I think is a significant piece of Chelan County PUD continuing to be perceived as an ethical partner and operator. And I just think that's a really important piece to kind of frame our thoughts about, you know, other related decisions in this marketing thought and process. But I just think that's an important piece. Thanks.
Commissioner Smith, you asked where we go from here. Because these are the first time these principles have been in front of the board in public, I would not want to try to move them forward at this point. I think we let them sit. I would even suggest this is important enough to maybe let them sit for a couple of meetings. We will announce through our press release that these are out there so that if there is an interest that folks have a chance to be able to contact us and let us know if they have any thoughts. So I would suggest maybe come back to this in about a month. And it also gives you some time to think, maybe hear from people in the county too, and make a decision as to whether you want to propose any changes to these.
Okay. Sounds like a good plan, Steve.
Commissioner Smith, I'd like to just make an ask, if I may. And that is that as we move forward and have future discussions on this topic, especially if we're considering an expansion of the retail load, I, in my opinion, and Steve, correct me, please, if I'm misinterpreting this, but with the retail load, don't we also lose the environmental and the capacity values that we do receive when we sell in the other markets?
That probably is the fundamental difference, because cost of production is just the cost of producing it. And the environmental and capacity values are essentially market values. So you, when you purchase, you get all the elements of the product, and so you would get a lower price in today's market. Like I say, a couple of years ago, they were pretty close. Today's market is different.
So I guess my ask would be, in order to help me to understand and quantify the value of that environmental and capacity load, if we could somehow separate it or give it a value, a life of its own, so that when we talk about perhaps increasing by 100 megawatts the power for available for local retail, not only is that potentially subsidized, but in addition, we lose that environmental and capacity value. So I just want to kind of wrap my head around, put that into making it apples and apples, dollars and cents, so that it's somehow comparable.
Yes, I'm with you. We have to do that because to meet the 5% test, we're going to have an estimate as to what the cost is. It may well not be possible to do 100 megawatts today and meet the 5% test. It may be a number smaller than that. 5% on retail rates is really only about $2.5 million a year. And with these kinds of megawatts, $2.5 million goes pretty fast. So, yes, not at all concerned with that request. Think that we are going to have to do it to be able to just comply with the principles that we've laid out here.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Steve?
You know, can I just add one other thing? Because I think Commissioner Arsenault's question really raises an important point that I've been thinking about and I'm not quite sure how to resolve. The market will move. It's going to move up and down. So it's been down. It's coming up. I can't say when these things will happen, but it will move up and down. One of the difficulties with that 5% calculation is we could maybe have done more a couple of years ago and met the 5% target, and then a couple of years later it turns out that that would have been too much. But there's no way to tell because you never know what the future market is going to be. So something that you'll want to think about is just how do we make those decisions? We've got this commitment coming out of the strategic plan that it won't be more than 5%. And yet that what is an opportunity cost is constantly changing on us. So I don't think we can make no decisions, so we will have to make choices based on best available information at a point in time, and then things can change from there. So just to be aware that think of that that amount for retail as kind of an accordion that moves up and down based on where the market is.
So, Steve, we have 5 or 6 minutes before the noon hour. Do we have any manager items?
We do. There's a few that we'd like to get in. And I believe Devin Myers is online. And
Yes, I am.
Great. So, Devin, would you jump in here?
You bet. Yeah, so I am Devin Myers, and I'm a project manager down at Rock Island, working primarily in the Powerhouse 2 refurbishment rehabilitation projects, and I just wanted to update you on one of those projects. That's the Powerhouse 2 draft tube gate cylinder and hydraulic power unit upgrades. There's no board action required or asked for today. Just, I know people say that, and I think it's important that I get that out there, but just kind of want to let you know where we are. So this is one of the projects that we're doing design build, this project was initially approved back in March of 2020 for $7.2 million and was going to run through 2021 through 2029 was the original schedule. After the bid went out, accounting reviewed and deemed that this project was capital because we're going to be replacing in-kind as opposed to refurbishing equipment. That was a deciding factor there. We've also determined that we could probably we'd benefit from accelerating the execution of this project believing now that we can get it done from 2021 through 2024. The total spend on the project remains $7.2 million at this point in time, although now we're moving it to capital, and we're estimating to spend about $2.2 million in 2021. and the remaining $5 million over the next 3 to 4 years. Are there any questions at that point in time? Do you have any questions about the project or what I'm... Okay. Okay. And so our next steps would be that by April 5th, we'd like to bring a resolution to the board for a capital budget revision, as well as executing a long lead procurement GMP so that we can procure the rod material and barrel material to build these cylinders for the draft tube gate projects. And then moving forward from there, we would like to continue developing, finalizing our designs and schedules. And then our goal would be around May 1st, bring you a GMP amendment for the first unit or two to be accomplished this year. And I'll leave it for questions there.
This is Kirk Hudson. I'd just like to thank Devin, but also add one just distinction here that when this was originally budgeted, as Devin pointed out, it was budgeted as O&M, so that this 2021 to 2029 project, you would have seen the budget come through every year with whatever money we were projecting to spend the next year. So the distinction that Devin's really pointing out, along with the long lead item resolution that would be coming at the next board meeting, is that with the capital budget revision, you would be asked at that point to improve the entire project rather than annually.
Okay. Thank you, Kirk.
You bet. And okay, I would also like to point out, just, boy, as hard as we've... struggled trying to get our projects done on schedule, it's a unique opportunity to actually accelerate something. So I'm actually kind of excited about that.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, Kirk.
I see John Wozniewski is online, and he had a manager item as well. We can get him in here, it looks like. John?
Sure. Thanks, Steve. Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Wozniewski. I'm an energy analyst with the Energy Planning and Trading Group, and I'll give you a quick update on Lake Chelan. And go to the next slide. Just a quick orientation. You can see the blue band there starting on October 1st is our forecasted operating range as of October 1st. The peach band is our current forecasted operating range from today's date moving forward. That dark green line is actual lake levels to the current date, and then the two lighter black lines there are the two target curves, the dry-in average and the wet target curve. So the actual lake levels, you can see we're quite a ways above the target curve, kind of in that end of November time frame, almost 5 feet at one point, but we've been able to draft with both units and get all the way down to our target curve here in the past week or so. So we have attained a full draft. We were also able to get up on a snow survey at the end of February, and based on the data we found, we had a March 1 preliminary water supply forecast of 111% of average, which puts us on that dry and average target curve. So you can see we've kind of started to follow that target curve to guide our lake level operations. Beginning April 1st is when we typically begin to refill the lake, so we do plan to do so this year as well. And we also, just on Sunday, started a unit overhaul for one of the units, so we are limited to one unit here for about the next month and a half. And next slide, I'll just show a bigger picture of the water supply. So on the top screen there, you can see from April to July for the Lake Chelan Basin. This is from the Northwest River Forecast Center. They're showing a 109% of average water supply, which is similar to the 111% that we came out with internally. And then on the bottom half of the screen there, for the larger Columbia River at Grand Coulee, at 94% of average water supply, and that's from January through July. I'd be happy to answer any questions about Lake Chelan or about the water supply forecast.
John, this is Ann Congdon.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for that. I'm always really interested in your report. So I'm traveling right now, so I'm listening. I'm not looking at your slides, although I'll look again when I get home. What do you anticipate being our lowest lake level, the lowest level we will reach before April 1 and we turn around and begin to raise the lake again?
Sure. Thank you for that question. Right now, the lake level is about 1,085.7 feet. And if we go back up to the previous slide, it's pretty flat where the target curve is now. So it may get a tenth or two below that, but I wouldn't anticipate much more of a draft before that April 1st time frame. And again, that all depends on inflows. So if we do have some very low inflows, we could draft a little bit further, but I would anticipate being fairly close to our lowest level where we are now, maybe another couple tenths of a foot.
Wow, that's high compared to other years, isn't it? So it's definitely on the high end.
No, that's pretty normal. That these two targets.
This afternoon we've got not a very large agenda, but coming back at 1 o'clock should work, Steve.
It should work, yeah, and I think we should be able to get through the activities that we've got before 2 o'clock, and then executive session.
Right. Okay, very good. So why don't we take a break for lunch and come back at 1 o'clock?
Welcome to the afternoon business session of Chelan Public Utility District Board of Commissioners for March 15, 2021. We're back in session. We've had some technological glitches on our Microsoft Teams system will not work. And so based on the authority that has been granted in these times with COVID on remote sessions, we made a rapid decision to change to a call-in format. And as such, there was no opportunity for us to notify the public, and there will not be any public in attendance that we are aware of. So we will leave it at that, and we will move on to our business agenda. The first item is the consent agenda, which this morning was modified to include resolution number 10. Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Mr. Chairman, I have to make such a motion.
Commissioner Arsenal, thank you. Second, anywhere?
I'll second that. Dennis.
Okay. Either Dennis or Steve seconded it. So
I think Steve did.
Okay. All right. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Hey, Commissioner.
So I'll turn it over to Steve Wright for resolution number 9.
Commissioners, I just wanted to let you know for purposes of public notice, I did ask Rachel if anybody calls in to communication from the public looking for number or call-in information, that we could provide that to them so they could call in. We did also confirm that no one had reached out to us beyond the participants for this morning. From the public asking for the call-in information or the links, which we would provide them if they did that. So I just want to make sure that it's clear that we are trying to accommodate public if they desire to attend.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay, Agenda 9, a resolution authorizing the general manager to approve renewals of the Oracle Customer Information System software. I'm going to ask Eric to describe this, although he won't be describing the substantive contract. This is one we're bringing to you under a bit of unusual procedure because technically we don't think it requires a resolution, but in interest of transparency, we're bringing it forward. Eric?
Sure, Commissioners. Everything that Steve said. No, I'm just kidding. Commissioners, just... for your information, I'll handle the process piece of it and may touch on the reason we're here. Ken Smith is on the line, and I believe Nicole Villacrez is also on the line in case there are substantive questions about the resolution. But effectively, Commissioners, what Steve said is accurate. This is a resolution for approval of ongoing support services related to the C2M project, the CIS-MBMS project. The original contract for the software and 2 years of support was included. That was $878,000 and some change, as was referenced in the factual background. That has or is expiring, and there is a need for new support services into the future for as long as we're going to have this product in place and continue to operate under the current paradigm. We are anticipating doing that through a combination of one or more year renewals. You'll see that the next year's renewal there in Section 1 of the action is for $124,000, almost $125,000. Presently, that is likely to increase over time. And depending upon some of the pricing breaks and other commercial terms, it is possible that we would do this in annual renewals or even potentially multi-year renewals if there was a reason to do that and it benefited the district. So Steve is correct that this is one that if we do this annually each year or even up to 3 years under the present pricing, it's done as a service agreement and technically under the board's delegation resolution, that would not require action of the board unless it exceeded $500,000. Because we will need this for such a long period of time, presumably, this annual renewal will quickly escalate and could be, you know, several millions of dollars by the time we're done. And the combined collective total then would be over the $500,000 delegated limit. That is not necessarily an impediment to not doing an extension without resolution. But the project team in conversation, given the options, did want to make sure that we gave the board a heads up on how we were planning to handle this because, you know, if we get down the road 10 years on this and there's one that comes up with an issue and the board has questions about why we've spent a little over $1 million, we wanted to make sure we had something to point back to. As a result of that, you will see Section 2, Commissioners, which is a little bit of a different language proposal, which is just a reminder and clarity from the board to staff that these future annual support and maintenance agreements, as well as licenses to the extent we need to expand the C2M project to accommodate any other uses, those will be approved consistent with the delegation threshold set out at the delegation resolution, which you have the number there, as long as the software remains in use. So it's really more of an opportunity to make sure the board understands how we intend to secure the support services and potentially expanded licenses with the C2M project into the future, just to avoid questions and give transparency. With that, I will ask Nicole or Ken if they would like to say anything substantively to support the resolution or answer any questions that the board might have.
Yeah, this is Ken. What Eric said is just right on, so I really don't have anything to add. Nicole, how about you?
No, I agree that sounded really great, and I agree we just wanted to be really forthright with the board on future expenditures to support this really important software to support our customers.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Nicole. Commissioners, any questions?
Eric, if I may, I just want to say I really appreciate the extra effort that you are all going through in order to present this to the board, and thank you very much for your transparency. And it just adds to the great amount of confidence that I have in staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to have to say that credit goes to the project team because we did give them the option, and they landed on this path. So that's the PCS group, Nicole, Ken, with the support of all of the managing team.
That even makes Gary's words more important because it tells me as a commissioner that the desire for transparency is going deep into the organization, and that's really good.
All right. Thank you, commissioners. Appreciate the feedback. Nicole and Ken, thanks for helping out.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Next up is Agenda 11, a resolution approving an interlocal agreement relating to development projects with the City of Wenatchee. Justin Erickson will present.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. It's a pleasure to be with you. This resolution supports an interlocal agreement that solidifies a partnership between the City of Wenatchee and the district with significant benefit to both parties and the community at large. These benefits come in the form of recreational enhancements in Riverfront Park and increased economic development in the city of Wenatchee. So just to orientate you a little bit here, Riverfront Park runs along the riverfront from north of 5th Street to where the trail connects with Worthen Street along the south end. Emphasis of our planning effort will be focused in the core area between 5th Street and Pybus, but we certainly understand that there's contextual issues on either side, and so the consultant will be looking at those as well. The city of Wenatchee owns the majority of the land in this area, although the district does own the land from the boat launch area south. And the district holds a ground lease, which has been in place since 1983. And we, of course, operate and maintain the park in accordance with our licensing requirements for Rock Island. We have spoken about this effort recently as part of the public power benefits updates that you were provided in December and February. And at the December 7th update, the commission indicated support to utilize $200,000 in PPP funding to match city funds for planning, and that provision is in the interlocal agreement. So speaking more specifically to the agreement, just a few key points for your review. The city of Wenatchee will provide $2 million for park planning and capital improvements. $200,000 of that $2 million is reserved for this initial planning phase. In addition to the $200,000 match that the district is providing, we will also provide $300,000 to the city for capital improvement projects. The city intends to apply our funding towards their redevelopment efforts in the North Wenatchee area, specifically associated with the McKittrick extension effort, which will build out Columbia Street and facilitate future private development along that property there that was formerly owned by WashDOT. The district's commitment to capital improvement projects in the city is provided as consideration for the city's $2 million commitment to Riverfront Park and the planning effort, and we anticipate that these enhancements will benefit the district and the public through the upgrading of public facilities and by improving recreation in the area. We further believe that such enhancements will also help market and ultimately sell the 5th Street campus site, and we're working on that RFP now. City funding, their $2 million commitment is being provided through their local revitalization financing fund, and that fund is geographically restricted to the waterfront area. While we've been working on this interlocal agreement, the district and the city have concurrently worked to select a consultant, agree on a scope of work, and so we're eager to get started on the master park planning effort. The master park plan is estimated to cost just under $300,000, so less than the $400,000 allocated. And we anticipate a robust plan with significant public involvement and really should provide great value to the city and the district for hopefully the next 20-plus years. Upon your approval of the resolution and the signing of the interlocal agreement, we will kick off this planning process late this month or in early April, and look to complete the plan in the fall of 2021. We have made it, both the city and the district are excited to follow up quickly with actual physical improvements in the park. And so we're targeting next spring of 2022 for the first phase or first wave of enhancements. So certainly look forward to getting this underway. Be happy to answer any questions that the commission has. I'd also like to thank Daniel Apple and Eric's team for his support with the interlocal agreement and his work with the city on that effort. Thank you.
Commissioners, any questions?
Brandy, this is Ann. I have a question.
You bet.
Remind me why we're using PPB money for this, why it's public power benefit money, not district. Is there not a business case to be made for it?
Yeah, I think when we brought this to you, late last year, we were still working out the details of the interlocal agreement and wanting to move quickly on the and not lose this opportunity with the city. And so we identified public power benefit as being a place to draw those funds. I think, you know, I think that there could be legitimate alternatives as well. And I don't know if Steve would like to add any commentary here, so I'll pause a moment.
Yeah, well, so there's a couple of different things. The interlocal agreement itself is just this exchange where the city is going to invest $2 million in the park in return for a $300,000 credit that we're giving them. So that's all that's in play today. Then for the planning effort, we will be using a portion of the $2 million from the city for planning, and then we were going to contribute $200,000 for planning as well. For that effort, there is no business case. It was not that we had a license requirement to do this. It was an opportunity to be able to do something to enhance that portion of the park. And so we concluded that that was legitimately a public power benefit initiative.
Additional questions?
This is Ann again. I guess maybe we'll talk another time, Steve, about if there's any way that could be just, you know, a district expenditure. Thanks.
Any other questions? So, commissioners, we have two resolutions, resolution number 9 and resolution number 11 before us. Is there a motion to approve these resolutions?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept Resolution 9 and 11 as presented.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second. Second. This is Steve.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to approve the two resolutions. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Case. Steve, more manager items?
We do have a couple that are left. John Stoll is going to come up. He's got two. So, John, or actually maybe John can be heard from where he's at.
Hello, commissioners. Can you hear me all right?
Yes,
we can. Yeah.
John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. The customer impact of the COVID-19 report was in your package. Hadn't planned to go through the entire package since really not much has changed. It's been fairly steady with one exception, and that has to do with the energy assistance. So that was slide 3 in your packet, and if you'll notice in February, it jumped up significantly. And that is the application of the federal funds that are then administered through community action with support of the PUD, where we saw it jumped up quite substantially in the number of customers and the average per customer. And this is strictly due to we're in a new funding cycle, so we anticipate over the next several months this will be a continued pattern. So people who've received that assistance in the past are now eligible again, so... Again, that's a program that will help help our customers who have those arrearages and help keep that steady and help in that effort. So stop there if there's any questions on that.
John, I just want to say thank you. Really, really great foresight and looking ahead and planning to help everybody concerned. Thanks.
Thanks, Ann. I'll pass that on to the team. I know also there – we've had an opportunity now that our staffing levels are a bit more stabilized. We're doing a lot of outbound calls, which I think have helped to making customer payment arrangements and guiding them to whatever assistance is out there. But I'll be sure and pass that on.
Great. Thank you.
Hey. Any other questions? Any other manager items?
We do. We have one. This comes back to a discussion with the board a few weeks ago regarding the bank stabilization and enhancement project out at the Rocky Reach Discovery Center. So we're going to show you some pictures about what could be done there. This is much the same as what the board has seen before. Commissioner Arsenault had some questions about how this fit with other activities that we had going on and whether we had any flexibility left with CPB funding for the remainder of the year. And I think what I might do is have Justin just go through this presentation real quick so folks have got a reminder about what we're looking at. And then Commissioner Arsenault and I can report on the conversation that we had about this as well.
All right, thank you, Steve. Thank you, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, at your February 16th commission meeting, we did discuss the allocation of remaining public private benefit funds for 2021. And that's when this effort, which we've affectionately termed the Rocky Reach Hillside Project, was discussed. You might recall some of the discussion from that meeting where the commission requested some additional financial and project details prior to final consideration, which is why we're back today. So since February 16th and today, staff has worked with the project team to advance design options and finalize cost estimates. So within your agenda packet, there was a four-page summary document that provided, some enhanced detail from what we presented to you before. So it included some better photographs that show existing conditions and highlight the challenges from an aesthetic and functional perspective compared to the status quo. We did take a hard look at what would it take to stick to a $400,000 budget on the penny, and then what can we do for roughly half that cost. And so there's two different options presented within that packet. The $400,000 option is pretty self-explanatory in the sense that it's sort of the full meal deal. The reduced scope option addresses the stairway, removes it and converts it to a ramp and provides one ramp to the upper lot, but no improvements to the lower walkway are made and no connection to the lower parking area is provided from the upper access door. And so I think when you look at the larger scope option, it really facilitates easier back and forth access. And more fully integrates the park with the Discovery Center and provides a landscaped backdrop that is pretty consistent in terms of quality with the other landscaped areas on the site, which, as you know, do create a pretty special sense of place when you're out there. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the commission has, or as Steve mentioned, I'm probably turn it over to him for a discussion that he and Commissioner Arsenault had recently as well.
Commissioner Arsenault, would you like me to describe the flexibility issue?
Yes, please.
Okay. So had a couple of conversations with Commissioner Arsenault, and his concern around this project came down to, I think, the with the presentation that we made to the board at the last meeting, all of the PPB dollars for 2021 would be allocated. And his question was, well, do we have any flexibility in case something comes up like COVID? You know, COVID gets worse for whatever reason, and we've been obviously very active in terms of trying to support the community in COVID. So what I shared with him is we do have some flexibility here. The board made a decision to, for example, fully fund the fiber acceleration program, even though that will not occur until into future years. That was a good business decision because it made sure the money would be there and that the fiber group could count on the fact that those acceleration dollars would be there to support the program. If we had something that came up that required a modification, there certainly would be some room there to be able to take a portion of those dollars and have them occur in a future year rather than this year. Our sense is that we're probably talking about something in the tens of thousands, maybe $100,000, probably at worst with respect to flexibility, but there is flexibility there. And I think with that, maybe Commissioner Arsenault, I'll turn it back to you as to whether that addressed your concern.
Yeah, Yes, thank you, Steve. And that was my major concern, was that we're in the first quarter of a year that is an unusual year. COVID is still with us, and there's even threats of new strains of COVID. And I just felt very uncomfortable spending all of our PPP money in the first quarter of this year. And so as long as we have access to additional funds and I think that makes sense for me. It certainly makes my concern feel better.
And so with that, we were at the point of looking for a head nod from the board, which the board gave us for the other PPB items for 2021. And so unless there's an objection, my understanding is we'd be in a position to proceed with this project for 2021 and recognizing that if there was an emergency situation, we do have some flexibility to be able to address that.
So I guess as the chair or the president of the commission, I would say that unless there's an objection, that's going to be translated as a head nod at this moment in time.
Just as a point of clarification, Steve, when you say this project, are you talking about the $400,000 rendition or the $200,000 rendition?
The $400,000, the one that was originally presented to the board at the last meeting.
Okay.
So hearing no objections then, I think you've got your head nod, Steve.
Great. Thank you. We will move ahead. I think folks out there are anxious to get going, so this will be good. With that, we're finished with manager items.
Okay, next item on the agenda are commission items, and there is a proposed motion for a strategy partners meeting in April. Would somebody like to place that motion on the floor? And if you're not looking at it, I can read it for you, and then you can say, I so move. Proposed motion would be, I would move to set a special meeting on Thursday, April 29, 2021 at 1 p.m. to be held virtually for the purpose of holding a strategy partners update meeting. Virtual meeting information will be posted on the PUD website. Is there a motion to that effect?
I so move.
Is there a second?
Second.
And moved and seconded to approve the meeting date. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So are there any other commissioner items today? Just a reminder that we have association meetings this week, and not all of us will be making everything. I understand that, but hopefully we've got all of our responsibilities covered. Follow up on delegation of action items.
We had quite a few from the last meeting. Two of them had to do with fish, information about fish return and survival that was requested from Catherine Willard, and the maximum beneficial elevation gain for fish ladders. Those both turned out to be, they've got some substance to them, and so we're not ready today. The first one we're going to plan to bring to the next natural resources quarterly update, and the second one we're hoping we'll be able to have an answer before the next board meeting. We need to gather a bit more information on the cost of reducing connection fees for purchases of low-income housing for tax-exempt organizations. There's some historical practice here at the district that we're getting a better handle on, and we'll be sharing that information at the next board meeting. We've got some additional information on the low-income program options regarding the financial impacts to customers compared to the other the cost of the program. So our plan on that is we needed to come back to the board anyway. That with really this last presentation was an interim report, in which we were getting some feedback. So when we got a better feel for the low-income weatherization program and some of the ideas about how to move forward based on the board's feedback, we'll come back to you on that. And the resource adequacy question is the big question, and we are putting together a presentation for the board. We're looking to actually try to time that with the when the Northwest Power Pool will be considering some key decisions on the resource adequacy, and we think that'll be in the next quarter sometime. And I would just mention that we're getting close, and hopefully you're going to see an email soon regarding the BB Bridge Park Wi-Fi pilot program and the challenges there in terms of how to get a provider to provide that service. And that's it.
Super. Any items from this week?
Neither Rebecca or I identified any. Did we miss anything?
One might be fixing our Microsoft Teams.
We'll give a call to Brad Smith about that.
Ian's probably already on the plane, headed over.
So, in,
the one thing, and maybe you and I can just have a discussion about this at a later date, is the on the retail load, the environmental and capacity dollar values, and we can talk more about that. You maybe help me understand. I just kind of, for some reason, can't wrap my head around it.
Okay. So we'll just plan to have a conversation. We'll make that a follow-up item. And okay. I should have identified that Commissioner Congdon had one as well to follow up on why the Riverfront Park investment would be a PPB investment. So I will... Mr. Congdon, we can talk about that.
Yeah, no, Steve, you answered it. Houston, I mean, that's your decide. That's your bailiwick. You know what constitutes a business decision and what does not, or what, you know, so I'm fine.
Okay.
You can leave that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So I recognize that we probably do not have any public in present, but this is the time for additional public comment if there's any members of the public present. In that case, we'll move on to 17, and that's any other matters that need to come before us before we go into executive session at approximately 2 o'clock. I believe that we've all been sent a new dial-in number by Rebecca. So at 2 o'clock, we will reconvene an executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCW. And that will be for approximately 1 hour.
I would suggest 90 minutes.
Okay, 90 minutes.
And Commissioner Smith, if you could start at 5 minutes to two, there's one other item that should come up, and I can tell you about it in executive session.
Okay, we'll start at, that's about 2 minutes from now. So, okay, we need to hang up and dial back in.
Great.
Very good.
We are coming out of no decisions were made, no votes were taken. And at this time, I will be taking any additional public comments if there's anybody. And with that said, we will close our meeting officially today at 3:14.
Thank you, Commissioner.